I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story. What you're hearing is Black Lives Matter protesters gathered in the centre of the US city of Portland. This sound has filled Portland streets for more than 60 nights since the death of George Floyd. It's not always this peaceful. Earlier this month, Donald Trump sent federal officers into the city who have used tear gas, flashbangs, and rubber bullets in nightly clashes with protesters. The president says it's all about taking a tough stand.
You know, if you look at what's gone on in Portland, those are anarchists. If we didn't take that stand, they were going to lose Portland.
Mr. President, federal agencies should never be used as your own personal army.
Remove your federal officers from the streets of Portland.
We are seeing the dry run for martial law.
Critics argued that the highly unusual move of deploying federal agents against the wishes of this Democrat-run city is a blatant electoral ploy. Today, is Donald Trump playing politics with Portland? It's Friday, the 31st of July. Anushka Astana is editor-at-large of The Guardian in London and host of the Today in Focus podcast, where this episode first aired. She's speaking to Chris McGreal, who's in Portland reporting for Guardian US.
Chris, tell me about Portland. Where is it in America and what is it like as a place?
Portland is the biggest city in Oregon. It's in the Pacific Northwest.
Chris McGreal is in Portland reporting for Guardian US.
And the Pacific Northwest's most sort of notable feature are endless trees.
Vast, vibrant, home to some of the most productive forest on Earth. Nearly half of Oregon is forest land.
You know, this is an enormous part of America, and it's a city that's essentially far from anywhere. The nearest other city is Seattle, which is a 4 to 5 hour drive to the north. You can drive it 8 hours south before you hit the California border and not really hit another proper city in all that time. So it sits out here in a kind of splendid isolation, really, inside what is quite a conservative state historically, but has become a bastion of liberalism.
Do you remember the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, people were talking about getting piercings and getting tribal tattoos.
Yeah.
And people were singing about saving the planet and forming bands.
Yeah.
There's a place where that idea still exists as a reality, and I've been there.
Where is it?
Portland.
Oregon?
Yeah.
Partly based on its isolation, partly based on its willingness on the whole to let people live their lives as they want to live them. And most recently, as the big tech cities, particularly San Francisco, but also Seattle because of Amazon, have attracted big industries that have driven up the cost of living, driven up the cost of housing, you see more and more people moving to Portland to escape those places. If you're an artist or something, it's also got a slightly bohemian feel to it.
And who lives there? Is it a diverse city?
Portland is the whitest city in America of cities above 250,000. And you really see that in this city. And that's partly because of its history. The black population of Portland is relatively marginalized and increasingly so because as this city's become gentrified with people moving in from other areas, they've been buying up property in those areas which were traditionally minority, traditionally black or Latino. And so you see increasing marginalization of minorities in this city, in what was already that overwhelmingly white city in the first place, in an overwhelmingly white state.
Tell me about the protests there. Where are they taking place and how long have they been going on for?
So the protests here began like they did in many cities in America after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May. Black Lives Matter protests took up all over the country. And you saw in Portland, completely expectedly, because of the nature of Portland and its history of protests, very many thousands of people were immediately out on the streets.
Portland police and protesters collided at 3 o'clock Friday morning.
Demonstrators blocked intersections near the Justice Center in downtown Portland earlier this morning.
What you saw initially were protests that then turned somewhat violent in the sense that there was a targeting, a smashing up of shops, particularly corporate shops like the Apple Store, which in turn led to the boarding up of a whole section of downtown. So the result is that there's a few square blocks of downtown, by no means the majority of the city, but this concentrated area around the Justice Center and some other official buildings there. They are effectively, particularly at night, under the control of the demonstrators. Those are the areas that have been boarded up because of the earlier protests and the smashing of the windows. Those boards are now covered in graffiti in support of Black Lives Matter and anti-capitalism causes as well. And all the days I've been going, I have not seen a single police officer inside that area.
Of course, white people are involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. But I do find it kind of surprising that the city where the protests have lasted the longest is so white. Why has the uprising in Portland lasted this long?
Partly because it's not only about Black Lives Matter. That has become a vehicle for some of the protesters for wider issues. Portland has a very long history of protests, so much so that somebody back in George W. Bush's administration, one of his officials, dubbed it Little Beirut. It was one of the first cities to protest after Donald Trump was elected. There's a sense of solidarity amongst people in Portland, an organisation as well. Perhaps also because it's not a huge city, and so it's more manageable than if you're trying to organise this in somewhere like Chicago. There's something perhaps a little of Paris about Portland. You know, they're very quickly to the barricades here.
And what about its history?
Its history is complex because Oregon is a state that was kind of born in an original sin of racism. Written into its first constitution was a ban on black people, people who weren't white, but it was aimed obviously at African Americans, from moving to the state. And there was an annual flogging of blacks who were in the state to encourage them to leave. That was obviously removed from the constitution eventually. But the racism continued. In the 20s and 30s, the city council was very heavily dominated by people close to the Ku Klux Klan. You might get the impression that Oregon was in the Confederacy from some of the attitudes. It wasn't. It was a long way away. It wasn't even a state when the Civil War happened. And even into the 1950s, you had what was known as redlining in this city, which essentially banned black people from buying property in large parts of Portland. Now, that's illegal, but it's still written into those old covenants. But it changed. It's changed really since the 1980s, partly because of the changing demographics of the city, partly just because the nature of America has changed.
Okay, so you've told us about the two sides of Portland, if you like, that strong undercurrent of racism through its history with a dwindling African-American population and a white middle class and largely liberal majority now. When the protests appeared to be continuing beyond perhaps where they were in some other areas, how did the city police respond?
The city police responded with tear gas, arrests, declarations of riots and breaking up the protests, much to the outrage of many people in the city, not just those who were on the streets. And one of the reasons is, having said it's a liberal city, it has a democratic mayor.
I feel conflicted in many ways. And
that democratic mayor is also the commissioner of police. And lots of people here felt that as commissioner of police, he was letting loose those forces against the protesters.
But I do not believe that violence or vandalism is the means to a political end. And I
whilst as mayor claiming he supported them.
There must be meaningful and lasting change to racist institutions that continue to deeply wound the black community.
He was accused of being two-faced, essentially. And that created a lot of controversy and backlash. To some degree, I think Ted Wheeler, who's the mayor, may have lost control of the police. They have a degree of autonomy. You saw a couple of things happen. Firstly, you saw the backlash on the streets over that. You also saw the governor of Oregon, Kate Brown, essentially push through a law limiting the police use of tear gas, which was upheld by a federal court.
I'm really proud that lawmakers came together to take several important steps forward, including limiting the use of chokeholds and tear gas, setting up a statewide database for police disciplinary cases, and preventing an arbitrator from overturning the discipline of a police officer.
So you see the police pull back, in part under political pressure, in part under the court order limiting their use of tear gas. And you see the protesters themselves essentially fill that space now, and they have control of the small area of downtown around the Justice Center as the police became more and more invisible.
And all of this, of course, is being watched by Donald Trump in the White House at a time when he's struggling in the polls. He's facing huge controversy over his handling of the COVID crisis and over the Black Lives Matter movement. It's clear to him Portland is a city where protesters will not go quiet. How does he respond?
He sees a political opportunity. I mean, he's in trouble. His election is far from reassured. And he is looking to essentially provoke confrontation because that plays well with his base. And Portland's the perfect place for him to do that because it's this uber-liberal city full, as he regards it, of anarchists and Antifa and troublemakers. So he says, I'm going to send in the federal troops to restore law and order.
There was a report out this morning that you're considering sending 175 federal troops to these cities to help local law enforcement. Can you fill us in on that?
It depends on what your definition of troops is. We're sending law enforcement. Portland was totally out of control. The Democrats, the liberal Democrats running the place, had no idea what they were doing. They were ripping down for 51 days, ripping down that city, destroying the city, looting it.
Which makes him look tough in his eyes and the eyes of his supporters. But going in and kicking a few liberal heads in somewhere like Portland plays well too.
And he was able to make that decision because of an executive order he signed in late June that was meant to be all about protecting US monuments and buildings, in this case, a federal justice building. But who are these federal troops?
So the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, set up a task force, and it essentially gathered officers from different agencies. Principally, it's the Border Patrol, it's members of the US Marshals Service, forces from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So different federal agencies that they were able to draw on, which notably have one thing in common: they have almost no training in being police officers, in policing the streets. That's not what they do. They go and arrest people at the border who are coming in illegally, or their US Marshals Service escorts prisoners. I suspect one of the reasons that those forces were chosen is that particularly the Border Patrol is very loyal to Trump. It feels that he's taken the handcuffs off in letting them go after immigrants, stuffing people into cages down on the Mexican border, as you will know. So they were the perfect kind of officers to send to somewhere like Portland because they would essentially do what he wanted.
What do they look like when they come in?
Well, one of the things that's really striking about them is that many of them are dressed in camouflage. They're wearing helmets. They're carrying warlike weapons, which is quite common for the police in this country anyway. But they certainly have an air of an occupying army about them.
Federal officers in full battle gear forced the protesters back with tear gas and pepper spray. Some of the agents wear insignia identifying them as police, but there are no badges or names.
There was a sense of this secret police force, this secret unit almost, being dispatched by the federal government to roam the streets of Portland.
I mean, it's the stuff of films, isn't it? It's the stuff of dark, sinister television programs like The Handmaid's Tale. It's not what you expect to be happening in Northwest America in 2020.
No, and particularly some of the early actions by the DHS force. They were filmed on the streets in unmarked vans, snatching protesters.
What is going on? We need to know. Who are you?
Dragging them into the vans and then disappearing.
Kidnapping people.
You just violated their rights.
They were taken to the courthouse and they were eventually released. But what they all said was they never knew who'd arrested them or detained them. They were never officially arrested. They were never given any record of having been taken away. These same forces were also quite violent in their response to some of the protesters. There were some very severe beatings. They were firing baton rounds up close, hitting people in the head. It felt very militarized in that sense as well.
But under whose orders? Who is saying that this is an acceptable thing? You arrest people, they don't even know who they've been arrested by.
Well, there's going to be plenty of legal actions over this, and there are plenty of lawyers running around saying this is completely unconstitutional. So there was an air of illegality and unconstitutionality about the whole thing. One of the things that isn't clear is below the very high levels of the Department of Homeland Security is who is giving the orders on the ground. It's not clear at all who authorised the idea of snatch squads and these beatings. And so there's a real sense of a lack of accountability.
How have protesters in Portland responded to all of this?
Well, what was notable about these protests before the federal authorities turned up is actually they were fading. The initial protests after George Floyd was killed were thousands of people out on the streets. By late June, early July, it was down to a few hundred a night. And whilst there were some confrontations and the courthouse had to be boarded up, really there wasn't a lot of momentum behind them anymore. It was just a dedicated core keeping them going out of principle. What then happens is once the federal authorities turn up, and particularly after video emerges of the snatch squads and the violence of the federal authorities, that completely re-energises the protest. And not only gets people back on the streets, but draws in a whole new crowd of demonstrators who are outraged at what they regard as trampling of constitutional rights by these federal forces.
When that happened, were you there for the protest? Did they start to feel very different?
They did. And one of the reasons was that you saw these groups of people come in that hadn't been involved in protests before. And well, perhaps one of the most notable is what's known as the Wall of Mom.
Moms are here, feds stay clear. Moms are here, feds stay clear.
That began with a woman called Bev Barnum, a mother of two children. She sends out a Facebook message saying, should we go down as mothers and help protect the protesters? And that really caught the imagination. And within 3 days, there were hundreds of women turning out to join what became known as the Wall of Moms.
Hands up, please stop shooting me. Hands up, please stop shooting me.
Dressed in yellow, carrying sunflowers and yellow peace signs. And they were the kind of people, many of them, who hadn't turned out before. I talked to a woman called Jane Ullman, who, by her own admission, was completely detached from the whole issue around racial injustice and police killings of black people until George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis. And then she said she decided to educate herself and she started reading and beginning to understand. But she said that it was the federal force response that brought her out onto the streets. And so she joined the Wall of Moms as a grandmother, saying she'd never been on a demonstration in her life. She's a chief financial officer for tech startups. And she said, I'm a very privileged white woman in a mostly white city, overwhelmingly white city, but this has brought me out. And you heard quite a lot of that.
Why are you guys here?
I'm here because of what I saw happen to a Navy veteran recently who was here to ask why the federal government is breaking the constitutional oath. And he did nothing other than ask that question. And he got beat up. I saw the video.
We are seeing more people out here than we've seen
in the past. I think early on, there were a lot of folks coming out immediately in the 3 weeks after George Floyd was murdered. And then we saw things kind of quiet down a little bit. Portland has continued to come out, but there were fewer people. And then when the feds came, it just exploded again. It was a tinderbox.
It's re-energized, reinvigorated the whole movement.
Doesn't sound like anti-capitalist anarchists then.
Well, this is the thing about the protests is that it's a very mixed bag of people. And as the protests go on each evening, they evolve. So, you know, around 8, 9 o'clock before the sun goes down, you have the marches and the rallies and the speeches. These are large and pretty peaceful. And so far in recent days, I haven't seen any intervention to stop them. What then happens around 11 o'clock at night after the main rally, a lot of the more middle class protesters drift away, they go home, and you're left with a harder core of protesters. Now, some of those have an agenda and they are anti-capitalists, and some of those people are up for a fight. Most of them wearing gas masks and helmets, some of them carrying things like leaf blowers to blow away the tear gas or baseball bats. And they are much more hardcore, dedicated part of the protest.
So some of the protesters are similar to the way that Donald Trump would have us believe all of them were, but you'd say that's a small minority.
Yes, and at the same time, most of what we see late at night with the firing of the tear gas and the back and forth between the protesters and the federal officers has become a ritualized nightly event in which one side provokes the other and then the other side deliberately overreacts. And this has really become a bit of theatre in that sense.
In response to all of this, we've seen some really strong language from politicians in the area. The Oregon governor, Kate Brown, tweeted, "This is a democracy, not a dictatorship. We cannot have secret police abducting people in unmarked vehicles. I can't believe I have to say that to the president of the United States." What has been the reaction of the city leaders?
So the mayor, Ted Wheeler, has denounced it at great length after the firing of tear gas, which he was caught up in to a degree.
Portland's mayor Ted Wheeler was wearing goggles when he was hit with tear gas while standing outside a courthouse last night. The mayor joined hundreds of protesters as they clashed with federal agents for the 55th consecutive night.
He accused Donald Trump of conducting urban warfare in Portland.
But then the federal government sent in dozens, if not hundreds, of troops. They engaged in what I would describe as really abhorrent tactics. And basically, they blew the lid off of this.
Wheeler has taken a very public position against the president, but it's met with great skepticism here, partly because actually he's had quite a long time to reform the Portland police as part of the broader Black Lives Matter agenda, and he hasn't done that.
Next, will Donald Trump's tactics in Portland help his re-election campaign?
So in Trump's eyes, if the protests are worsening rather than calming down, if there are thousands of people on the streets rather than hundreds, hasn't his decision backfired?
Well, certainly the stated intent of the federal authorities restoring law and order has failed completely. All those federal officers are doing is defending the courthouse as their kind of citadel, because it's a federal building. It's their job to protect it. And so that's why they're centred on that building. And that's really why the fight nightly has become over the courthouse. There's nothing in that courthouse that goes on that the protesters are particularly objecting to. What they're objecting to is that the federal forces are based there and are using that essentially as their springboard in the name of restoring law and order on the streets of Portland. If, on the other hand, the president's intent was to stir up trouble, because that's what he likes to do. He likes to create confrontation and then try and get political advantage from it. He likes to pit people against one another. He likes to distract from the very, very real issues in this country, not least coronavirus. Then he may feel that to some degree it's been worth it, because here we are talking about it. The television cameras are focused on it.
And that's obviously what he's hoping for right now, because he is in trouble when it comes to the November election, if the polls are to be believed. And from everything you've said, it sounds like he's trying to frame this as political theatre, to place him on one side of the fence as this law and order president cracking down on out of control protesters in this liberal democratic city. Do you think there is evidence that he is achieving what he wants to achieve, that the Republicans who he needs to vote for him in November's election see this as a victory for him? And if so, is that why he's now talking about sending federal agents into other cities as well?
He will tie the Democrats to this. He will say, a Democratic governor, Democratic mayor, this is evidence that the Democrats are extremists, that they're on the side of disorder and chaos.
They're Democrat-run cities. They're liberally run. They're stupidly run. They've run them poorly. It was always bad, but now it's gotten totally out of control. And it's really because they wanted to fund the police. And by
he's hoping to provoke trouble. I'm pretty sure about that. He doesn't want to quell it. He wants to make it worse. Whether that pays off for him is a much bigger question, because in the end, if you look at why he slid so far in the polls, it's because he has failed to provide real leadership on the one issue that matters to people in this country at the moment, which is coronavirus. Americans can see it, particularly in some very important swing states. His approval rating has dived because of coronavirus. And I don't, in the end, think that whatever he's trying to do is really going to turn that around for him.
Chris McGrail, thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
On Thursday, in a major reversal, the Trump administration began pulling federal paramilitaries out of Portland. Oregon's Governor Kate Brown said she agreed to the pullout in talks with Vice President Mike Pence, and that state and city police officers will replace Department of Homeland Security agents in guarding the federal courthouse that has become the flashpoint for the protests. That's it for today. Thanks to Chris McGrail for his time. To get the latest on what's happening in Portland, you can check out his reporting at theguardian.com, and we've put some links on the full story page. This episode was produced by Sam Colbert and Rachel Humphreys, sound design by Nicholas Cox. It first aired on the Today in Focus podcast. If you like this episode, you can subscribe by searching for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Okay, catch you next week.